The Arctic 30, as they became known, are a group of Greenpeace activists arrested and jailed by Russian authorities and charged initially with piracy. Their ship of Dutch registry was seized in international waters last September, along with all of their equipment and personal belongings, most of which have never been returned, even though the Arctic 30 were all eventually released by Russian authorities just in time for the Sochi Olympic Games. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn, and today on the Kathleen Dunn Show, we'll hear their story and the story of Russia's ambitions in the Arctic and a little bit about its prison system. My guest is Masha Gessen, a Russian-American journalist and author of several books, most recently the best-selling biography of Vladimir Putin, The Man Without a Face. Her article, published in the June 2014 issue of Harper's, is titled Northern Exposure, Protests, Petroleum, and Putin's Dream of a Russian Arctic. Masha Gessen, welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Thank you for having me.
The seizure of the Arctic Sunrise, the Greenpeace ship off Murmansk last September, didn't, at first at least, attract a lot of attention in this country. And in fact, I don't know that it ever really made all that big a splash in terms of headlines. So for those who are not familiar with that story, could you just briefly tell us what happened that led to the seizure of this ship and its crew?
Sure. And I think actually one of the most fascinating things about the story is how little attention it attracted in this country. What happened was that a Greenpeace ship called the Arctic Sunrise went to was in international waters of the Arctic to protest Russian oil drilling in the area. And it was seized by the Russian border guard. And again, I repeat, it was in international waters. The ship was towed to the port of Murmansk, and the 30 people on board, including one freelance photographer, and including citizens of 18 different countries, including two U.S. citizens, were thrown into Russian jail. And they spent 2 months behind bars and then another month in limbo in St. Petersburg while Russian authorities were trying to figure out basically how to get rid of them, because, of course, having kidnapped them and taking them onto their territory, they actually had a bit of a legal problem on their hands. Basically it was a kidnapping of 30 people in international waters and the seizure of a ship in international waters by Russian authorities.
Now, this isn't the first time that protesters have been arrested for protesting Arctic oil drilling. And usually, as you point out in your article, there's a wave of international protest, and that's enough to secure their release. This time, it was different. What made this time different?
Well, actually, Greenpeace doesn't just protest oil drilling in the Arctic. I mean, Greenpeace has staged many, many protests over the course of more than 30 years in various parts of the world. And they are accustomed to having their people taken into custody and released after a day or two. Because, well, in most parts of the world, a peaceful protest is not a cause for throwing people into jail. And Greenpeace protest is peaceful. So I don't think that international outrage is the key element here. I think the key element here was a basic sort of misunderstanding between Greenpeace and Russia. I think Greenpeace thought it was protesting business activity, commercial activity in the Arctic. It was protesting the environmental threat to the Arctic. And Russia was interpreting this as a threat to its territorial ambition. And we know, we've learned a lot more since about how Russia behaves when it feels rightly or wrongly that its territorial ambition is threatened.
Well, let's talk about that territorial ambition for just a moment. Obviously, parts of Russia lie above the Arctic Circle. They do have some territory there. I understand that a Russian explorer and legislator planted a titanium flag on the seafloor below the North Pole or at the North Pole extend the claim of Russian territory to the North Pole. Talk a little bit about what the Russian interest is in the Arctic. Is it oil and gas? And if so, why? It seems a rather expensive proposition.
It's not oil and gas. I mean, oil is something of a pretext. But yes, drilling in the Arctic seabed is prohibitively expensive. The cost of actually getting a barrel of oil out of the seabed there is about 10 times what that barrel of oil will fetch on the market. So it's obviously not cost efficient, even if the costs go down as time goes on. But it is very important to Russia as a symbol and a symbolic territory. It's a project that Putin has personally presided over for the last 10 years. The project is called the Russian Arctic. And yes, planting a titanium flag at the, on the seabed, in a gesture sort of very reminiscent of the 17th century, except for the titanium part, is very much a part of that. Russia has also been sending expensive expeditions, onto its Arctic territories to clean them up. And to sort of try to figure out ways of revitalizing them, re-inhabiting them.
So this is about Russian nationalism.
It is about Russian, I'd say it's about Russian imperialism, which is a little different.
Okay, well, that's nuanced enough for public radio. So the eventual goal is to just kind of mark the territory and say, this is ours, stay away. I mean, the incident that we were talking about initially with the Arctic 30 took place in what apparently everyone except Russia agrees is international waters.
Right. It's well, Russia is confused. I'd say some of the people involved are sort of purposely confused, and some of the people involved are just ignorant. These are international waters for the purposes of maritime activities. They are the exclusive economic zone of Russia, so Russia is the only country that can engage in economic activity there, which is why Russia could plant an oil platform there, and other countries could not. However, Russia cannot restrict the movement of ships in the area, which is something that came as a surprise, apparently, to the Russian Border Guard, and something that the Russian Border Guard refused to recognize. And there was also an incredible moment in the court in Murmansk when a local prosecutor was confronted by a terrific defense attorney who sort of addressed her and said, the prosecutor is probably not aware that that Russian private property is not the same thing as Russian territory. And the prosecutor sort of mumbled and huffed and puffed and said that it was the job of Russian law enforcement to defend Russian property wherever it happened to be, which I think is something that should give, you know, London city authorities a lot of pause, because there's certainly a lot of Russian real estate all over the world that a prosecutor like that could decide to defend.
So the oil platform in question in international waters was anchored to the seabed, so it wasn't a ship. The Arctic 30 were charged initially with piracy. It's a little baffling because there none of the conditions for piracy were actually met.
Right. That's one of the funny parts of the story, if it weren't so sad. The definition of piracy varies somewhat from country to country, but by Russian law, piracy is an attack on a ship that is committed with the use of arms and for the purpose of seizing property. Now, that fits what the Russian Border Guard did. The Russian Border Guard boarded the Greenpeace ship. They seized a lot of property, which still hasn't been returned to either Greenpeace or the Dutch, because the ship is actually, it flies the Dutch flag. But the platform, yes, it's stationary, so it's not a ship. And the Greenpeace activists tried to scale the platform, but obviously they had no weapons, unlike the Russian Border Guard, and they didn't try to take any property.
And the Russian Border Guard in this case had no insignia, no recognizable uniform. They wore masks. They rappelled down onto the Greenpeace ship from a helicopter. Did they announce themselves as Russian border guards, or did they just show up and start shooting?
It was a pretty long ordeal, according to the people who were on the ship. There was a border guard ship that was in negotiation with the Greenpeace ship. That's who opened fire, and they threatened to open fire on the ship, but apparently saw thought better of it when, after the Greenpeace activists pointed out that that would be tantamount to a declaration of war against the Netherlands. So there was a lot of shooting into the water and into the air. But then a helicopter came, and people boarded the came off the helicopter and boarded the ship. And those people had no insignia. They did not identify themselves in any way. They gathered most of the crew in a single space in the on the ship, then searched them and transferred them to the lounge. They took the captain hostage on the bridge. And no, they had no identifying marks. I think the Greenpeace activists basically knew it was Russians, and they knew that they were probably the border guard, although they may not have been. In fact, we still don't know who those people were.
Yeah, that was one of the many puzzling aspects of the story. There was another piece to this that I wanted to be sure that we brought up as well. At one point in the proceedings, I think this was when they were still at Murmansk, the judge came into the courtroom with a type sheet that already had the decision on it. More or less before anything started, the decision had already been made as to what the outcome was. Is this common practice in the Russian justice system?
It is absolutely typical for the Russian justice system. The decision is usually dictated by the prosecution, so you can know what the wording is going to be because it's lifted directly from the charges. It's unusual for the judge to be that blatant. Usually they sort of maintain a semblance of decency. They don't actually show the typed opinion until after the hearing has happened. So it was a sort of a heartbreaking moment because the defense attorney got very excited for a short time about the fact that he had caught the judge with a typed opinion. He was also excited because I happened to be there, so there was actually media coverage. But it was media coverage ultimately in Harper's Magazine, and there weren't going to be any repercussions against the judge for violating the law so blatantly because, well, who was going to punish him? The system works like that.
Hmm. And then the Arctic 30 eventually ended up in jail in Russia. You hear a lot of stories about the Russian prison system, most often that it's corrupt. It's a breeding ground for drug-resistant tuberculosis and HIV. Tell us a little bit about that system. I understand that there's a red system and a black system, and there's a pretty big difference between the two. Would you describe the conditions that these prisoners were held under?
Right. The very strange distinction between red zones and black zones is a distinction between prisons that are run by the prison administration, which can impose its own arbitrary rules, but still it's the law enforcement officials who are running the prison. That would be the red zone. And then there are the black zones, which are actually run by the prisoners. They're self-governed in the worst imaginable way. So there's a criminal hierarchy that runs the prison. There are a lot of convoluted rules that are very difficult for novices to learn, especially if the novices don't speak Russian, as was the case for obviously a majority of the 30 Greenpeace activists. There's a part in the story where the captain of the ship, Pete Wilcox, describes getting into major trouble for throwing out a piece of moldy bread because one of the convoluted rules that everybody in the prison system is supposed to know, and the black prison system is supposed to know, is that you never throw out bread because bread is sacred. That sort of thing. It's a system of rituals that is intended to separate those who can be trusted from those who can't be. And it's a system of control.
800-642-1234 is the number to call if you'd like to join our conversation. We're talking about the incident of the Arctic 30, as they became known, a group of Greenpeace activists arrested and jailed by Russian authorities. They were originally charged with piracy. They were eventually released just in time for the Sochi Olympic Games. We're talking about what happened to them and maybe in the bigger picture, what the Russian interest is in the Arctic. How Vladimir Putin as president has shaped some of this Russian policy and what it says about the culture, the climate in Russia, not the environmental climate as far as temperature and snow and rain and things like that are concerned, but the social climate. All of those are fertile fields for our discussion today. 800-642-1234. Email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. And you can also join us on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page and leave your comment or question there. My guest, Masha Gessen, Russian-American journalist, author of a number of books, including a biography of Vladimir Putin, and the author of an article that that appears in the June issue of Harper's Magazine, and is titled Northern Exposure, Protest Petroleum, and Putin's Dream of a Russian Arctic. We'll continue our discussion after we take a short break, and you can join us, 800-642-1234. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's our number, 800-642-1234. That's a different number than the one you normally use to call the show, 800-642-1234. We're talking about what happened with the Arctic 30, a group of Greenpeace activists arrested in jail by Russian authorities on charges of piracy, although they were eventually charged with hooliganism. And I want to talk about that with our guest a little bit as we move along here as well. 800-642-1234. Lines are available for you to call right now and join our discussion. My guest is Masha Gessen. Masha Gessen, a Russian-American journalist, author of a number of books, including the national bestseller The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin. Her work has appeared in Vanity Fair, The New York Times, Newsweek, Slate, and many other publications, and her most recent article appears in the June edition of Harper's and deals with the Arctic 30. So the let's talk for a moment. You wrote a biography of President Putin. You obviously have researched him extensively. Kind of tying that to this Arctic 30 incident, is this a product of the kind of Russia that Putin is trying to create?
Absolutely. And again, I think we've learned a lot more about what kind of Russia it is since the Arctic 30 incident with the invasion of Ukraine. But you know, I think Greenpeace didn't quite understand what had hit them. They initially came up with a strategy that seemed intelligent but was totally misdirected, which was the idea was to give Putin an exit strategy, a phrase that we heard a lot a few months later, again after the invasion of Ukraine. But they were hoping to give Putin an exit strategy and sort of allow him to blame the kidnapping on business, on the gas monopoly, which owns the oil drilling platform. What that failed to take into account is that it was actually Russia's national ambition itself that Greenpeace had gone up against. And that's very much how it was perceived by the Russians. I believe everyone from the border guard on up to the president. It is his personal project, this the Russian Arctic project. But even more than that, it's this the national ideology of expansion and an aggressive defense of what Russia perceives as its territory that has really taken hold under Putin.
It starts to echo some of the 18th and 19th century talk in the United States about manifest destiny and all of that sort of thing. Would you see some similarities there?
Absolutely, yes. And I think I even used that phrase in the article. But that's very much what it made me think of, this this idea that even if it's international waters and even if the world has decided, you know, where the lines are drawn in the Arctic, Russia just knows that it's theirs.
Mm-hmm. How was this trial and the case of the Arctic 30? Was this covered in the Russian press? And if so, what was the coverage like? And how did people in Russia react to this incident, if they reacted at all?
Well, the Russian press is a whole other conversation. What's left of it, and that conversation is going to get very short, very soon. But there was some coverage in the independent media, what there was of it at the time. And I think the independent media perceived it very much as falling in line with the many political prosecutions going on in Russia at the time. And of course, this the ultimate charge that was levied against the Greenpeace activists, which is hooliganism, is also highly symbolic for Russian protesters, because that's a charge that's been levied against many of them, including Pussy Riot. And hooliganism is defined as the crude disruption of the social order, which is pretty hilarious, because one wonders what kind of social order they were disrupting out in the open seas. But again, it's this idea that that there's a common understanding of how people should behave and what things should be like, and any disruption is punishable, even if it's not punishable by law. There has to be an article will be found. So if piracy didn't stick, and the reason it didn't stick was because the Netherlands ultimately filed suit in the International Tribunal on the Law of the Seas. If piracy didn't stick, then they would stick. They would make hooliganism stick, and they would have if it hadn't been for the Olympic Games and such.
Let's take a call. We have Ray with us from Milwaukee today. Ray, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, I tuned in a little late, and I just caught the tail end describing the treatment of these prisoners and the court hearings and all that. We in America, we have no leg to stand on anymore because of torture and Guantanamo Bay and Abu Ghraib. So we can't address that issue as Americans right now unless we are going to start charging the CIA with what they did to prisoners. Some of those prisoners, by the way, were children, and they are still being held at Guantanamo Bay. But we don't have to feel helpless about this situation. We can, as Americans, refuse to go to the gas stations. Get rid of your gas-powered lawnmower. Stop taking trips in airplanes. Try riding a bike to work or maybe a bus. There's a million ways that we can fight the oil monopoly in the whole world if we just stand together with that. But as far as the court and what happened in Russia, we look far worse than what happened to these Greenpeace people, even though it was wrong. We really can't we can't say anything about it because what we've allowed to happen here in our country.
Ray, thanks for the call. Masha Gassin?
You know, I don't like that line of argument. I absolutely agree that the United States is not without reproach, and I absolutely agree that what's happened in Guantanamo, what continues to happen in Guantanamo, needs to be addressed. But I think once you take that in the direction of we have no leg to stand on, we can't say anything about this, what you're actually doing is exactly what happened to the Greenpeace activists, which is essentially they were abandoned. The United States didn't do anything, at least publicly, to protect its citizens who had been, again, kidnapped in international waters. And, you know, it was amazing. While I was researching the story, I went to see Captain Phillips, the movie that came out at around the same time. And I went to see it with my teenage son, who was very impressed by the story. And the story, for those who haven't seen the film, is that Captain Phillips was the captain of a ship that was taken that was attacked by pirates outside of off the coast of Somalia, and the captain himself was taken hostage by the pirates. Because they pushed the pirate button, the entire might of the U.S. Navy and all the international anti-piracy machinery kicked into gear, and he was liberated in very dramatic fashion. And so my teenage son was sitting next to me and saying, did this really happen? Like, because of one guy, they sent these Navy ships out there to save them? And it did. When a U.S. captain was kidnapped by Jimmy.
Masha, we're losing your cell signal. I don't know if you moved at all or not, but we're having a lot of trouble understanding you at the moment. I'm going to take just a moment while we sort this out and give the phone number again. See if anyone else wants to join us on our discussion. 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. And you can also post your comment or question on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. We're talking with Masha Gessen, a Russian-American journalist, about what happened to the Arctic 30, as they became known specifically, perhaps in a broader context, the vagaries of the Russian justice system and prisons and so forth, Russian interests in the Arctic, and all of that, all fair game for our discussion here. 800-642-1234. Masha, let's continue from where you started to be garbled there when it's sort of in mid thought, as we were discussing some of these issues. I just try and pick up where you were, and we'll continue on.
Sorry about that. So yes, what I was saying was that when Captain Phillips was kidnapped by a bunch of skinny black guys in motorboats, the might of the U.S. Navy was there to save him. When Captain Wilcox was kidnapped by a bunch of heavy white guys in helicopters, the United States was essentially silent.
Let's be clear on this. There were American citizens on board this Greenpeace ship.
There were two American citizens on board this Greenpeace ship.
The captain is American. Okay, and there were several Russian citizens on board. Where were the other people from who were captured?
Well, there were 18 different countries, so I don't think I can list them all.
Well, right. Okay, so there were a lot of different countries, but there were two American citizens. And what you're saying is that there was no overt reaction at all from the United States government.
That's correct. It took a lot of lobbying to get the Dutch government involved. It was ultimately forced to get involved because the ship was flying the Dutch flag. So it filed suit in the International Tribunal on the Law of the Seas, which I think helped the prisoners a lot. But that was actually a month into their ordeal.
Yeah, and you said basically the Russians ignored the tribunal. That's pretty significant, because that doesn't often happen, does it?
Well, again, the Russians have since demonstrated exactly what they think of international law, it really, I wasn't shocked by their reaction, but a lot of people were shocked, because Russia is one of the conveners of the International Law Tribunal on the Law of the Seas. And once the Greenpeace had successfully lobbied the Dutch government to file suit, they were sure it was going to have an effect. They could not imagine, in their worst nightmares, they could not imagine that the Russians would just say, no, we don't recognize the International Tribunal on the Law of the Seas anymore. They refused to go in. They refused to represent themselves. The tribunal ruled in Russia's absence, and it ruled that the people had to be released, and that the ship had to be released. The people were ultimately released, but not for another couple of months, and the ship is still docked in the port of Murmansk.
The intimation in the story is that it's still there because it was so stripped of equipment that they didn't want anyone to see it.
That is what I'm told by the people who saw the Russians on the ship. I haven't seen the ship myself, but the Greenpeace activists and the captain say that that they saw the Russians stripping it basically of everything. I think the captain was somewhat optimistic about the Russians being able to get it back into seafaring condition in the course of, he said, a couple of weeks. But apparently they haven't done it. And I think that some of the equipment that they took, they apparently took for the purposes of the criminal case. But most of it, I think, was just looting.
Let's take some more phone calls. John is with us from Milwaukee. John, go ahead.
Yes, hi. I appreciate the program. It's very enlightening. It's kind of curious, though. I first of all, your a comment on your last caller talking about Guantanamo Bay and how we don't have a right to try to police international waters and give ourselves the ability to be a country here and go after somebody in the Guantanamo Bay situation after the greatest aspect of terrorism and the greatest loss of life in our country's history. So I'm not entirely sure what he was talking about, but your guest is extremely enlightening. I think as Americans, we kind of have this view that, you know, real nice countries like China and Russia are friendly and happy, and they have the same judicial system that we do, but they're under communism. They've been involved with a communist way of life for years and years, irregardless of a real happy, a real happy Olympics and things that they put on. We've got this view that they're a nice country, they're a friendly country, and they're just like America, but they're not. They're based on communism. There is no judicial system. They don't have a right. The people don't have a right like we do in our country. And I'm glad that the caller is letting people see through her eyes how other countries really treat their people and treat the judicial system and this is true, and this is exactly, I think, what Putin and the rest of their quest is in the country, and their direction is to claim stakes to international waters and other countries like they are in Ukraine. And thankfully, your guest is telling us exactly how these other countries function. And it's about time we hear it and we gain that education.
John, thanks for the call. I think Russia hasn't been communist for a number of years, but we get what you were talking about. Masha Gessen?
Yes. I think it doesn't have anything to do with communism, but it does have everything to do with a complete disregard for the rule of law. And I agree, the United States was blind to Putin's destruction of what there was of Russian democracy and the judicial system for a long, long time, for much too long. I think that at this point, the United States do realize just how bad things are in Russia, but it took a while to grasp it.
What is the state of the pro-democracy movement in Russia these days? They were pretty active at one point. There were some incidents after President Putin won re-election in the most recent election that they just kind of disappeared. What's the status of the pro-democracy movement in Russia today?
Well, I wouldn't call it a pro-democracy movement. There was a series of mass protests in Russia in 2011, 2012, but calling it a movement implies the existence of an organizing or coordinating structure that simply didn't exist. So it was a fairly easy thing to crack down on, which is exactly what Putin did. I also wouldn't call what happened with Putin in March of 2012 a re-election. He claimed re-election, which is a little different, but he controlled the ballot and he controlled the vote count and he controlled the entire process. So there wasn't much of an election there. But anyway, he came back into office for his third term as president. At this point, it's fairly clear that he's planning to stay in office for the rest of his life. And as a dictator, he's really chosen the most effective way methods for staying in power. He has cracked down on the protesters. He has cracked down on the independent media. At this point, Russia has dozens of people who are in jail for political protests. This is something that was not the case just a couple of years ago. So this is a new phenomenon, the fact that people are going to jail for political protests specifically. And that sends a very strong message that it's just way too dangerous to go out onto the streets to protest, and it will accomplish nothing anyway. And, of course, launching a war is also very good for dictators. It boosts their popularity, as Putin has proven yet again.
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, he seems to be very popular with a great deal of the Russian population. Is it because he's attempting to restore some pride after the fall of the Soviet Empire, and make people forget the debacle in Afghanistan, all of that kind of stuff, making him feel good about being Russians again? Is that what this is about?
That's part of what it's about. I mean, we have to be careful when we talk about popularity in an authoritarian state, because Putin controls the airways. I was just in Russia for a couple of weeks. I just got back 3 days ago. And I watched some Russian television, and it's really scary. It's constant war propaganda, 24/7. It's anti-Ukrainian, anti-Western, anti-gay, hour after hour, day after day. And there's virtually no alternative point of view available to people. So that's part of how that popularity is achieved. And part of it is, of course, offering Russians a national idea for the first time in a quarter century. And yes, a very easy way to find pride in being Russian. It's a pretty horrifying event that that is offered out as a source of pride, the annexation of part of a neighboring country. And yet a lot of people are willing to accept it.
800-642-1234 is the number to call. We have some callers waiting. We'll get to them in just a moment. You could be one of them at 800-642-1234, talking with Masha Gessen about the Arctic 30 and other things about Russia. 800-642-1234. Talk at WPR.org is the email address. And you can also leave a comment or question on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. We're going to take a short break. We'll come back with more of our discussion in just a moment. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today. In this hour, we're talking, we started out talking about the Arctic 30, a group of Greenpeace activists who were arrested and jailed by Russian authorities for piracy. Charges which were later dropped and replaced with charges of hooliganism. They were eventually released just in time for the Sochi Olympics, perhaps as a sop to world public opinion. We're talking with Masha Gessen, a Russian-American journalist, author of a number of books, most recently the national bestseller The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin. Her work has also appeared in Vanity Fair, The New York Times, Newsweek, Slate, many other publications. She's also received numerous awards, most recently the 2013 Media for Liberty Award. 800-642-1234 is our phone number, and let's go to the phones and hear from Kurt in Chippewa Falls. Kurt, thanks for calling us today.
Yes, you're welcome. Earlier, somebody raised the issue, your guest explained that the entire regime of anti-piracy and freedom of the seas was brought to bear in the case of Somali pirates, but there was a great reluctance to do so with regard to the Greenpeace boat. And I'm going to suggest that maybe the difference is that in the case of the Somali pirates, they have been interfering with business and costing businesses millions and millions of dollars, whereas Greenpeace is the one interfering with business. So in both the situation is such that in both cases, it is better for business interests to prevent Somali piracy, but better in the business interest to permit Greenpeace to suffer this setback.
Masha Gessen?
That's actually very much sort of Russia's logic. Russians were surprised, the Russian authorities were surprised by the international reaction they did get, including from the Dutch government. And the message that I heard, not for publication, but that I heard from Russian officials was, look, everybody hates Greenpeace. We just are the ones who had the courage of our convictions and actually took them and threw them in jail. Everyone should be grateful to us. So there may be a grain of truth to it. I think it has more to do with the fact that Somali pirates don't have nuclear arms or negotiating power, and Russia does. And even when they commit the exact same act, the reaction of the United States and how much the United States is willing to do for one of its citizens is vastly different.
Kurt, thanks for that call. Let's go next to John in Milwaukee, a different John this time. John, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. I just sort of object to her of the author's attacking Russia for doing things that are sort of what like we've been doing for 400 years in our country.
You want to expand on that at all, John? What you mean?
The expansion, yes. The expansion of the colonists in American over the Indians. And then the Spanish-American War and World War One and World War Two and the Korean War, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
All right, John, thanks for the thought. Masha Gessen, we don't have anything to complain about because we've been expansionist ourselves.
Well, I kind of fail to see the truth in that. I'm sorry. I think there are a lot of faults with the United States, but I don't see how the United States has been expansionist in terms of territory, especially sort of in the post-colonial era, I mean, in the world's post-colonial era. So I don't understand the argument.
John, thanks for that call. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. You mentioned Pussy Riot earlier, and you published a book about them, the Russian feminist punk rock protest group. They were also jailed and then released just prior to the Olympics. Your book was titled Words Will Break Cement. Talk a little bit, what were the similarities between their case and the case of the Arctic 30?
Actually, there are quite a lot, and I think in a way they're almost identical, except that that Pussy Riot were unlucky enough to land in jail for 2 years rather than 2 months. But they were both charged with hooliganism, and even though the charge sounds absurd, as I mentioned earlier, it's the crude disruption of the social order, I think there is a grain of truth to it in the sense that both were perceived as attacking what Russia holds to be sacred and key to its identity. So in the case of Pussy Riot, they went into the largest and gaudiest cathedral in Moscow, and they performed what they called the punk prayer, in which they appealed to the Mother of God to chase Putin out. What they were actually protesting was the symbiosis of church and state, which is something that's essential to the way that Russia functions today, and it's also essential to Russia's identity. And the same thing with Greenpeace. They were protesting oil drilling, which is essential not only to the way that Russia functions, but also to its identity. And they were protesting Russia's treatment of the Arctic, its treatment of it as its own, as its dumping ground, as territory that it can do anything that it pleases with. And that is also essential to Russia's identity. And both suffered repercussions that they couldn't have predicted, precisely because their protests were even better targeted than they themselves realized.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a call from Mike in Madison next. Mike, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. I think this occurred after the Olympics, so maybe it's in addition to what you just said, but concerning that Pussy Riot, they did some kind of a commendation to the Solidarity Singers in Wisconsin. I can't remember the format that they used, if it was U2 or what, but I heard something about it. And I was wondering if she would know if there were any repercussions from that for the group.
Masha,
I couldn't make out what the caller.
Okay, well, he was asking whether or not there were any repercussions. Pussy Riot apparently did something in support of the Solidarity Singers, who were protesters here in Wisconsin, and was wondering if they were prosecuted for supporting the Solidarity Singers.
They have not been prosecuted for anything since they were released from prison. They have, however, been attacked. Repeatedly physically attacked in Russia. I think Russia has actually become a very unsafe place for them, but they continue to they continue to do their work there. They've emerged from prison as prisoners' rights advocates. But what they have tried to do, I think, is very smart and very admirable, which is that when they're invited to speak in other countries, such as the United States, they have tried to talk not only about the problems with human rights abuses in Russia, but the human rights issues that they see in the countries that they're visiting, which is why they talked about the Solidarity Singers, and which is why they also talked about the Occupy Wall Street protester who was convicted of assaulting a police officer. I think that's a very good strategy, and again, I think it's very admirable and wise of these young women to do this.
What about your own situation? Your biography of President Putin was, to say the least, critical. What's your status when you say you were just in Russia? Do you fear for your own safety? Do you fear that you might be arrested?
I have a dangerous profession. Russia is the most dangerous place in the world to be a journalist. It's certainly the most dangerous country that's officially at peace to be a journalist. I think I'm a lot safer than most of my colleagues because my work is published so widely in the West and because I have a fairly high profile. And at this point, I live outside of Russia, so I still do a lot of reporting from there. But I'm based in New York, so I think that makes me a lot safer than the people who are on the front lines.
You say that that President Putin apparently plans to stay in office for life. What is your hope for Russia's future?
If I had any hope for Russia's future, I probably would still be there. I am feeling very bleak about what's going on there because I think that, first of all, as I said earlier, his crackdown has been very effective. I think he's done everything right. If he wants to stay in power, it's not good for the country. It's terrible for its economy. It's terrible for its people. But if all he's concerned with is holding on to power for as long as possible, he's doing everything right. So that's one thing. The other thing is that a regime like that is destructive, not just to the economy, but to the very fabric of society. And I'm not sure that a country can recover, a society can recover from decades of Soviet rule, decades of dictatorship and abuse, followed by a very brief period of upheaval and democracy, and then the last 15 years of the restoration of a dictatorship. And the longer this crackdown goes on, I think the worse Russia's prospects are for restoring its society, its culture, its political culture. All of that takes people and energy and emotional and psychological energy that I think is being drained from the country.
The if you were giving advice to the rest of the world's governments, particularly the United States, vis-a-vis its relationship with Russia, what would you warn them about? What would you like to see done that we haven't seen done yet?
You know, I think in some ways it's actually become very easy to deal with Russia because at this point Russia is truly a rogue, aggressive regime. It will be aggressive no matter what the United States or other Western countries do. So there's no strategic planning to be done here. It comes down to ideals, to morals. It comes down to doing the right thing. Once we realize that, once we sort of come to terms with the fact that there's nothing that can be effective in dealing with Putin, we can talk about what the right thing to do is. And the right thing to do is obviously not to deal with Putin, not to negotiate with him, not to sit down with him, not to go to his party, I'm referring to Sochi, but also to various other international events that Russia is still trying to host, to isolate him, and of course to implement economic sanctions.
Mm. It begins to sound like the policy of containment during the Cold War. And have we returned to a sort of Cold War with Russia?
Well, Russia hasn't actually asked the United States if it wants to return to a Cold War. It's been fighting its own war against the United States, well, its own Cold War against the United States, for a number of years, and the United States has insisted on ignoring it and pretending that it's not happening.
Mm-hmm. We just have a little bit of time left here. What ultimately has happened to the Arctic 30? They've been restored to their homes. If they lost some personal possessions, what ultimately has been their fate?
The Arctic 30 received an amnesty in December of last year. Some of them were intent on rejecting the amnesty because they actually wanted to stand trial. But once the police got orders to get rid of them, they were pressured into accepting the amnesty. And some of them were promised, for example, the freelance photographer, Denis Sinyakov, who's a Russian citizen and a terrific photographer who was held. He didn't want to take the amnesty, but he was told that the only way he could get back his cameras and his film was if he accepted the amnesty. He accepted the amnesty, and he still hasn't received most of his things.
Well, we're out of time here. Masha Gessen, thank you so much for joining me and telling us this story today.
Thank you for having me.
This program was produced by K.P. Whaley and Marika Suval, on-air production handled by Dave Potras today. As you may have heard, poet, performer, and political activist Maya Angelou died today at the age of 86 after a long illness. Kathleen had a great interview with Maya Angelou last year about this time, and you can learn more about Maya and there's a link to Kathleen's interview at our website, www.wpr.org. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn this week. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.